Greetings to the Griffith Memorial Lecture. I'm delighted to welcome today Dr. David Jenkins, a very distinguished historian who's had a distinguished career with the Museum Service in Wales, specialising in industrial and maritime history. I'm proud to call him one of our own in that he is a native of Montgomeryshire, who went to Newtown High School and then to the University College of Aberystwyth. In fact, we discovered not so long ago that we'd actually coincided, albeit briefly, overlapped at Newtown High School. David has made a special interest in maritime history, and it's no surprise, therefore, that he's taken a special interest in the industrial history and the life and legacy of David Davies of Llandinam, which is the subject of tonight's lecture. Please give a very warm welcome to Dr. David Jenkins.
Well, I'm going to give you a nos with that. Diolch yn fawr iawn I chi. Am y gwahoddiad I ddod yma heno, dwi'n cyfri hyn braint arbennig I ddarlithio i'r Cymrydorio. Many thanks for your kind invitation to come here tonight. It's a delight to be here, and it's a great honour for me as well to be lecturing here this evening. This lecture could be said to have grown out of an exhibition, a major exhibition that was mounted at Angerdfa Cymru National Museum Wales in Cardiff in 2007 to celebrate the centenary of the granting of the museum's charter. And it was thought appropriate that the centenary exhibition should celebrate the museum's most generous benefactors, the Davis sisters of Kirkconnell, and the wonderful art collection, of course, that they gave to the museum. But for the first time ever, it was an exhibition that looked at the Davis family from the bottom up. There was an extensive introductory section for which I was responsible that looked at the industrial background of the family. David Lewis in the corner over there was a great deal of help at that time. We published an excellent book, still available, Things of Beauty. Priest wrote the introduction. But there's also an element of sort of personal piety about this, because when I was 10 weeks old in September 1957, my late father took up a post as headmaster of the primary school at Tregunnog, which is of course the village just a mile down the road from Tregunnog. Miss Margaret Davis, Miss Daisy as she was known in the village, was still alive then. I am reliably informed that I was reasonably well behaved in my pram when I was invited up for, when Dad and Mam were invited up to have tea with Miss Davis. And I do have the vaguest child's recollection of having been introduced to her. She used to pay for the school Christmas party every year. So it would be Christmas 1962. I'd be in my first year in school, and Miss Davis died the following spring. So it is, as I say, something of an act of personal piety as well. And then as we grew older, I'm afraid that Kirkconnell became a bit of an adventure playground as well for myself and quite a few other lads from the village. There were all sorts of interesting things to mess about with, and we did get sent off with our tails between our legs. I do remember a lift had been installed in Kirkconnell for Miss Gwendolyn when she fell ill, and there was a big sign on it, "Do not use." Well, if ever there was an invitation. And in we went, up, down, and then the thing juddered to a halt, and you could see this much on one floor and our feet on the other, and we were being shouted at from both directions and off home. Anyway, if the Davis family is known for something today, it is, of course, the two sisters and the wonderful art collection that they bequeathed to the National Museum in the 1950s and 1960s. But it's often the case that great art is always backed up by great wealth. And we only have to think of Renaissance Italy. But one wonders how much of that wealth, how much of that art would have developed had it not been for the fact, of course, that Italy at that time was the banking centre of Europe, Northern Italy, Florence and so on. Think of the wonderful art that came out of the Netherlands in the 17th century as the country embarked upon its global expansion, free from the fetters of Spain. And think also of here in the UK, there'd be no Tate collection but for the sugar industry. The Burrell collection in Glasgow was founded completely on shipping, of course. And it's here that the coal industry in South Wales gave rise, of course, to the Davis collection. But the family, of course, did not come from South Wales originally. And the man who, more than anyone else, was behind it all, of course, was David Davis, Top Sawyer, Davis the Ocean, his one of many nicknames. Seen here at the height of his 19th century industrialist pomp, if you like, outside the door of Bron Eirion, the house which he built for himself at Llandinam, and about to set off on a day's shooting with his favourite spaniel, Midge. Is rather a scene where you tend to think and tell Midge to get out of the way, but that was David Davis's great joy, hunting not on horseback but on foot, after woodcock and snipe and so on, and he loved nothing better on a Saturday when he was back up from South Wales than to go off hunting. But he came from very, very ordinary background, of course. This is the little small holding of Drang Tewion, high up on the hillside to the southeast of Llandinam, where David Davis was born in December 1818. And I think that the only marking of the bicentenary of his birth was a programme that myself and my former colleague Bill Jones contributed to on Radio Cymru. There seemed to be no other marking of the bicentenary of David Davis's birth last December. He was the eldest of nine children, many of whom died of TB. Apart from farming, David Davis's father also worked as a sawyer. Montgomeryshire, of course, is well known for its wonderful oak timber-framed houses, and its oak was once shipped away down the River Severn to be taken round to Portsmouth and Plymouth to build the ships of the Royal Navy. The young David Davis soon developed a sort of innate ability as a quantity surveyor. He could look at a tree and say to within a few feet how much useful timber could be extracted from it. He could look at a gap that needed to be filled with an embankment, work out how much material would be needed, how many days it would take with however many men. And from these beginnings, he took out the tenancy of Gwernairin Farm at Llandinam, and we're actually standing in this picture on the land of Gwernairin. And here in the foreground is what kicked David Davis's career off. This is an embankment which he built alongside the banks of the River Severn. Never mind the bridge, I'll come to that in a minute. But he built embankments alongside the River Severn to protect the lands at Gwernairin from the massive floods of that the Severn used to experience every winter before Clywedog was built. I have, again, a child's recollection of seeing the big floods of 1965, seeing somebody rowing down Broad Street in Newtown. But he built these embankments to protect his land from the River Severn, and this work came to the attention of John Penson, who was Montgomeryshire's county surveyor at the time, and recognising that here was a competent man who would be unable to undertake public works offered Davis his first contract in 1846 for the construction of this bridge across the River Severn at Llandina. The bridge, Davis didn't build the actual bridge. Of course, the bridge came as a massive Meccano kit from a foundry in Harden. But Davis built the approach abutment to the bridge, and based on that then, he was soon getting contracts all over Mid Wales for various works. An early contract was the Smithfield at Oswestry. It's now the sort of town car park. I can remember going here with my grandfather as a child. And then there was also in 1849 to 1850 the construction of this bridge, Nyadd Bridge, on the road from Llanfair Cereinion over towards Maslwyd, crossing the River Banwy at Pont Nyadd, just a few miles west of Llanfair. And it was whilst he was building this bridge for Penson that he met up with his future wife, Margaret Jones, who came from Awern, a farm nearby at Llanfair Cereinion. She, like him, a deeply devout Calvinistic Methodist. He'd met her whilst he was attending, whilst he was working at on the construction of the bridge. He'd met her in the little chapel at Bethlehem on the back road from Llanfairpwll to Meifod. And it was there that they came together and they got married in 1850. The railway history of Wales is one in which by the mid-19th century you had main lines across the northern extremity of the county, the Chester and Holyhead Railway from Chester to Holyhead, and the South Wales Railway from Chepstow right through. It was originally supposed to have gone to a terminus at Abermawr here near Fishguard, but the Irish potato famine put a stop to that and it went down to Nayland instead. But in the 1850s, most of this area of Mid Wales was completely devoid of railway lines. And it was during this period, in the late 1850s, that David Davis was approached to undertake the engineering work for a railway from Newtown to Llanidloes. Now, it was a rather odd railway because it wasn't connected to anything else. The canal came to Newtown, but those of you who know Newtown will know that the canal basin was a long way from the station, so transshipment wasn't an easy thing. But nevertheless, in 1859, the railway from Newtown to Llanidloes was opened. But it wasn't long afterwards before Davis was working on other lines, and particularly the Oswestry and Newtown Railway, which opened in 1861. And Oswestry was already linked to the Chester and Shrewsbury Railway here. So the railway was then connected to the rest of the national network. But by far, and Davis was also building railways elsewhere at the same time. He was overseeing the construction of the Vale of Clwyd Railway up to Denbigh from Rhyl off the North Wales Coast Main Line. But the engineering work for which he's perhaps most famed as a railway builder is, of course, the Newtown and the Llanllyth Railway, which was under construction between 1862 and 1864. And what made that railway construction quite a feat was, of course, the cutting at Tylerdig, where the railway cuts through from the watershed of the Upper Severn into the watershed of the Twymyn and the Dyfi to go down to the sea. And again, we see here Davis's innate skills as a quantity surveyor. Why didn't he just tunnel through this rock? So save himself a great deal of trouble. Well, what Davis did was to treat the cutting as a quarry. And so by digging out all this, and it was good hard stone, He then had building material to build all the bridges all the way down the line, almost to Chemice Road. And you can actually see, if you get out of your car on the A470 and cross a field and mind the cows and so on, the railway crosses the River Twymyn one last time before it swings round into Chemice Road and into the Duddy Valley. And you can actually see there where the Telheddyg stone ran out. The piers of the bridge are in stone so far, and then the rest of the bridge is in Rhabon brick. You can actually see there where the Telheddyg stone ran out. So again, that is just typical of the man. In why build a cutting? Well, a vast amount of raw material instantly provided. Another little touch of personal piety as well to Tregunnon. David Davis was not always at one place at one time. When these railways were being built, work would be going on at a number of locations on the same railway line. And also, as I showed earlier, there was work going on the Vale of Clwyd railway at the same time as he was building other railways. And Davis did have to depend very, very considerably during this period on men of the same sort of caliber as him, men who were able to, became his trusted lieutenants, if you like, and who oversaw the construction of the railways. And one of those was this man, Evan Jones, from Fachwen Isa, the lower Fachwen in Tregunnon. He was one of Davis's most trusted lieutenants, supervising navvies on a number of places on the Newton and Machynlleth Railway. But when Davis turned his attention to the coal industry in South Wales, Evan Jones decided that he wanted to stick with railways, emigrated to America, and eventually ended up as the principal builder of most of the railway lines in Texas. And he died an extremely wealthy 90-year-old bachelor in Austin in the 1920s, with huge investments, not just in railways, but also in lumber and in cattle ranching as well. A quite remarkable man. He's recognized in America. There's an excellent biography of him, but we certainly don't make enough of him on this side of the Atlantic. The economy of Wales was utterly transformed during the late 18th and 19th centuries, of course, by the fact that the Industrial Revolution took root readily here. We had water, we had coal, we had limestone, everything we needed. In the early 19th century, the foundation of the industrial economy of South Wales was, of course, the iron industry. But by the 1860s, as railways developed, as steam propulsion at sea developed, the demand for coal and the importance of the coal industries gradually outstripped that of the iron industries in South Wales. The mines started to be sunk to exploit the high quality steam coal at the centre of the coalfield. to take a cross section of the South Wales coalfield from Merthyr down to Tom Gwynlais and see how the coal measures go, well, basically it's like a cross section of a pudding bowl. They outcrop near Tom Gwynlais, they outcrop near Merthyr, but then they take a massive dive. And then, but the best quality steam coal was there deep in the middle of the coalfield. The Cynon Valley, up to Aberdare, was started to be exploited in the 1840s, and then it was during the 1850s that the Rhondda Valley began to be exploited, and it was in 1864 that Davis moved down to South Wales and began to take a large mineral lease extending from the upper end of the Rhondda Fawr over across to the heads of the Garw and Ogwr valleys, which come up from Bridgend. And it was here in 1865 to 6 that he sank his first pit, the Maindy Colliery at Tom Pentre. Now, it's one of those fascinating pieces of industrial history, or rather we should say the sort of urban myths of industrial history, that Davis is supposed to have been sinking this pit, and as I say, the coal seams were really deep down. They were going down, no coal being found. And Davis ran out of money, and he's supposed to have said, right, here's my last half crown, that's it, I've had it. And they said, right, we'll work for another week for nothing, and of course, bingo, they hit the coal. Well, this is one of the great industrial urban myths. Exactly the same story is told of Henry Schneider, the German pioneer of the ironworks and the iron mill mines in the Barrow area of, well, Lancashire it was at that time, the bottom end of the Lake District. And I also remember a B-movie in which a certain Ronald Reagan plays a prospector for oil in the Persian Gulf, the Gulf of Mexico. And he too is sinking well after well after well. But then at the end of the film, he is snogging Lana Turner in a massive gusher. So it is, I swear. But Davis, this was the one time in his life where he was really exposed. 10 years ago, since the financial crisis and everything that's echoed down the last decade, but it was noticeable that some of the more perceptive and knowledgeable commentators at the time made much of the fact that this was the first time when Northern Rock went into trouble, that it was the first time that there'd been a run on a British bank for 104 years. And indeed, they were true, because in 1866, British banking was absolutely rocked by the collapse of the Overend Gurney Bank here in London. The Overend and Gurney families were, like the Barclays, good Norwich Quakers who had made good and had established themselves in London, but unlike Barclays, which is still with us today, Overend Gurney got into terrible trouble. Oh, excuse me, I think I'm coming down with a cold, but I shan't blame you. The Overend Gurney Bank collapsed, and whereas the banks in 2008, 2009 were bailed out by the government, that was not the case in 1866. And Overend Gurney soon began to drag banks all around the country down with it as it went. Now, Davis had to borrow substantially to sink the colliery in the Rhondda. It was one time where he had to borrow. We don't know the exact sum, but we do know that he borrowed it from the North and South Wales Bank. Anybody know whose branches on those streets of Wales today are represented by the old North and South Wales Bank? No, it's HSBC. Midland took over North and South Wales Bank, and it's HSBC. As a matter of fact, there's a lovely plaque on the bank, the Midland HSBC Bank in Welshpool, noting the fact that it was opened as a branch of the North and South Wales Bank. But the director of the North and South Wales Bank, which amusingly was actually based in Birkenhead, told him, "We are okay. We are not in any way exposed to the crisis that is dragging down banks all over the country." And that was the one time in Davis's life when his progression as a notable industrialist was really under threat. It is, as I say, the one time in his life, but the fact that the North and South Wales Bank remained solid meant that he was able to develop and develop his coal interests. So here, as I said, is the original taking that he rented from the Marquesses of Bute, and stretching over from the top end of the Rhondda Fawr, as I say, to the Garw and Ogwr valleys here, down to Bridge End. Then in the 1860s, he took on this area here, 1867, the Lady Windsor Colliery at Ynys y Bwl, and then whilst it was in David Davis's last days that negotiations started for the acquisition of this area around here in around Treharris, where the Deep Navigation Colliery was eventually sunk in the early 1890s. So that was the extent of the Davis's colliery interests. And it's notable really that the after David Davis's death there was no further expansion. It was his pushing that set up this much of the of the coal industry. That's the Lady Windsor Colliery at Ynys y Bwl, opened 1886, closed 1987, so it lasted 101 years, I can remember that working. And here's a pre-First World War advertisement for the company. Eventually the collieries were all brought together into the ocean, into a limited liability company, the Ocean Coal Company Limited, most of the shares of which were held by members of the Davis family. And it's interesting to note here that the blurb for the coal is unrivaled for steam navigation and railway purposes, well-known markets, economy, sunshine, purity, durability. For some reason, they kept using this term Merthyr, a lot of these South Wales companies, because this is where South Wales Steam Coal was first dug. It gave it some kind of merit. But as we can see here, Cunard Company ships solely use Ocean Merthyr Steam Coal, and it was also on the Admiralty list, the Admiralty Best Welsh Coal. As you can see here, English Admiralty for trial trips, and of course for the use of the royal yachts. Queen Victoria did not want to get smuts on her crinoline. So and it was during David Davis's life far and away the largest and most prominent of the South Wales colliery companies, but it was overtaken after his death by the Powell Dufferin Company. As I mentioned earlier, that Evan Jones from Tregunnan didn't accompany David Davis down to South Wales when he started to exploit the coal resources of the area, but hundreds and hundreds of people from Montfermeilshire did follow him down to South Wales. And this is a reunion of some of those who followed him down, taken in the 1890s at the Eastern Colliery at the head of Rhondda Valley. I can remember in Tregunnan as a child quite a few. You'd go into houses and you wouldn't expect, the last thing you'd expect to see was a collier's, a miner's lamp. But there were a number of elderly people in the village, if you remember, Billy Williams and old Howe Davis. They'd all spent some time down in South Wales working in some of the ocean collieries. This was only pointed out to me when I was giving this talk in the Fonda a couple of years back. We know the obsession with selfies today and taking photographs of, but look at this chap here, determined to be on the camera. One wonders if 10 seconds later they're sort of slithering down the back of them. But I think that's a lovely piece of crept up. And there are guys here on the headgear determined to be on the camera. This is the house that David Davis built for himself at Llandinam, Bron Eirion, mid-1860s. I think it was 1866 when Bron Eirion was finished. This massive Italianate mansion on the north side of the valley, but he built it here because he could, by looking across from the house, he could see the three places that were really important to him in his life. First of all, he could see Draenteilion, high up on the hillside opposite. He could see the railway station, which was on the first line he built, the Llanidloes in Newtown, Llandinam station was there. And he could also see, of course, most important of all to him, the chapel. He never had a home in South Wales, always made a point of coming back to Llandinam on the weekends so that he could take his Sunday school class in the chapel. And so Bron Eirion was situated purposely so that he could see those three pillars of his life from the windows at the front of the house. Cardiff docks in the 1870s. Coal was king of the late 19th century. And South Wales steam coal had a significance in the world that is can only be compared to oil today. The development of the coal industry in South Wales, however, meant that gradually a tremendous bottleneck began to develop. Cardiff is, of course, on the mouth of the River Taff. The Taff Vale Railway ran up the valleys north of Cardiff into the Rhondda Cynon and the main Taff valleys and brought the coal down. But it was soon, by the 1870s, it was becoming perfectly clear that the railway was incapable of handling the output of the ever-growing output of the collieries up the valleys. And it wasn't long before David Davis started to look around and considered, conjunction with other coal owners, up in the Rhondda, how he could develop a new port somewhere in South Wales to export the coal. In the 1870s, coal wagons would be running in rakes of about 30 or 40, and it was considered good going if your wagon could make it from the colliery to the port and back twice a week. But what Davis wanted to do was to develop a railway system, a new railway system, which would be much more efficient and enable those trucks to get back and forth three trips a week from colliery to the sea. The first area he considered building a port was actually on the mouth of the River Ogwr, Ogmore by Sea, which is today just a collection of twee bungalows between Porthcawl and Barry. But it was at Barry that he eventually decided to construct a new dock, filling in the marshland between Barry Island and the mainland, and constructing there this notable dock. And this is the number one dock after its completion in 1889. There was, of course, a protracted dispute from 1884 to 1889 with the Bute interest in South Wales. They didn't want their interests and their docks at Cardiff being undermined by this upstart competitor, but Davis won the day. And if you go to the House of Lords Record Office, there are scores and scores of volumes bound in red Morocco evidence, Barry Ports and Barry Dock and Railway Bill. A great deal of very, very important information there. You can see these two little chaps here, on hopes that they got out before the waters let in. What's important to note as well is that this is just a coal port. This is not a port for anything else. There are no warehouses here for importing general cargo. There's not even a continual quay wall. There are just these abutments with the tips against which ships come, and the coal is then tipped in. And the dock was also linked to a new railway line. And this is the marshalling yard at Caddoxton, just east of Barry, where all the coal wagons from the various valleys and the various collieries came down. If you think of the Barry Railway, you sort of think of an octopus with a head at Barry, and then tentacles reaching out to every one of the coal valleys from the Llanby in the west to the Rhymney in the east. And so Davis was able to draw coal from all these valleys and all these collieries. And at the height of the coal trade in 1913, when 10.5 million tons of coal were exported from Cardiff, and just over 11 million tons from Barry, there was a coal train arriving here in this marshalling yard every quarter of an hour, night and day, which just goes to show, as Gwyn Thomas once said, we wonder here in Glamorganshire that we have anything left to stand on, or that the world will ever go cold. Which I think is a lovely line about the dock opened on the 18th of July 1889, and to cock a further snook at Barry, Davis made sure that the first ship to come in was a ship from Sunderland and not from Cardiff. The Arno, owned by the Thompson family of Sunderland, and Thomas Rowe Thompson, who ran their Cardiff office, had been one of the major promoters of the Barry Dock and Railway Bill, along with David Davis, and so it was very, very appropriate that it was the Sunderland registered Arno that opened the new dock in 1889. And Davis is somewhere here amongst the crowds, it was the penultimate crowning achievement, so to speak. He died the following year. I haven't looked at all his other achievements in the terms of education, of religion, and so on, otherwise we'd be here all night. But he was, of course, a quite remarkable man. He was also ever so slightly boastful. There's a wonderful story about Disraeli listening to one of his long-winded speeches during the time that David Davis was MP for Cardigan Boroughs in the 1870s and 1880s, and said that it is indeed wonderful to hear Mr. Davis praising his maker. Of course, he's commemorated in these two wonderful statues, one which stands outside the docks office here at Barry, and an exact replica, of course, by the first contract, the bridge at Llandinam. And Jan Morris, in A Matter of Wales, is of the opinion that this is the finest piece of public statuary in Wales, and I am inclined to agree with her. Davis was succeeded by his only child, Edward, who was born in 1851. But he was most definitely not a chip of the old block. He was a man who would have far preferred to have been a research chemist. He was, quite frankly, utterly overawed by the responsibility of the vast industrial empire that he inherited from his father. There are some wonderful letters written by his daughter Gwendolyn to Thomas Jones in the collections in the National Library, which express with great fervency the absolute horror that he had of administering this massive industrial empire. And such was the strain that he died 8 years later in 1898. And he left 1.25 million. I checked up last night on one of those very useful websites which give you current value. It would have been 97 million, which shows you what David Davis had achieved. But unusually for the time, the entire fortune was not left to David, the eldest son, but it was shared equally between David and his two sisters, Gwendolyn and Margaret. And it was because of that generosity that the sisters were then able to go on and acquire the art collection. The eldest son, David Davis on the left here, the first Lord Davis, of course, of Llandinam, was very much a chip of the old block, and not only ran the coal companies, but became Liberal MP for Montgomeryshire, served in the trenches in the First World War, quarrelled regularly with Lloyd George, and then his eldest son here, Mike, he unfortunately he was killed. David Davis died in 1944, and he was followed shortly afterwards by Mike, who died of his injuries whilst with the Welsh Guards in Holland in 1944. And his son, of course, is the present Lord Davis. And here are the two sisters at... here's Gwendolyn and Margaret, and here they are at the inauguration of the first pithead baths anywhere in South Wales. I don't know, Priest, do you remember we had a sort of colloquium one day in the Reardon Smith Lecture Theatre, and there were people getting up and shouting there were never any pithead baths in South Wales before the industry was nationalised, and it was very nice to be able to bring up this picture of the inauguration of the first pithead baths anywhere in South Wales by the Davis family down the ocean colliery at Deep Navigation in 1916. Obviously, these guys here are the managers of the various ocean collieries. Here is William Jenkins, who's a distant cousin of the sisters. I'm not sure whether it was a mother or grandmother was a sister to David Davis, who went down to Breconshire to live, but he served as the Ocean Coal Company's managing director up until the time of the First World War, and he was succeeded then by Thomas Evans here, who was the company's director then, until managing director, until the nationalisation of the coal industry in 1947. And here, sitting between the two sisters, is their formidable stepmother, who really kept both girls on a very, very short lead indeed. There's not much terribly surprising that they never married with quite such a formidable old Harrington as her, controlling almost every aspect of their lives. I'm sure that those of you who conducted historical research will always have had the pleasure of looking for something and then seeing something else, and ooh, that's interesting. And I was researching a biography of Sir William Raydon Smith 10 years ago, and I happened to notice, it was in a rather dry volume, The Fair Play Summary of British Shipping Finance from 1936. it was a full thing if you're interested in shipping history, because it gives you the share capital of shipping companies, the shareholders, the major shareholders. And I noticed there that this, of course, is one of the vessels of P.A. Campbell, the White Funnel Fleet, that ran an extensive fleet of pleasure steamers in the Bristol Channel from the 1880s to the 1980s. But I was surprised to see that after members of the Campbell family, the major shareholders in P&A Campbell were the Davis sisters of Cricknock. Now, this rather amused me, but it does make sense because in 1905, the Barry Railway launched a series of steamships in competition with P&A Campbell. Campbell's responded with all the classic tactics of a threatened monopoly, legal cases, cutting fares and all the rest of it. And by 1911, the Barry Railway gave up and sold their ships to Campbell's. And so the Davis sisters inherited a large chunk of shares from the Barry investment, which then was taken into P&A Campbell. What is amusing, however, of course, that the sisters, of course, were strict, famous for their strict teetotal adherence. But the P&A Campbell steamers, of course, were famous on the then Welsh, dry Welsh Sabbath. A booze cruise is nothing new. One wonders when they opened their dividend checks from P&A Campbell whether they were aware how much of that had come from sales over the bar on a cruise to Ilfracombe or Minehead on a pleasant day in the Bristol Channel. Just one of those little asides that's always so amusing. The Davis's industrial empire came to an abrupt end, of course, with the Labour government, the post-war Labour government of Clement Attlee, which nationalised both the coal industry and the railway lines. The railway lines in Mid Wales had later been swallowed up by the Great Western Railway, and David Davis was the one of the two Welsh directors of the Great Western Railway, the other being William Tatum, Lord Glenelg in Cardiff. So the railways were nationalised in 1948, and the collieries the previous year. This image here of the demolition of the Walnut Tree Viaduct at Taftswell, just north of Cardiff, in a way sums up the end of the Davis's industrial empire, with the viaduct had originally carried the branch of the Barry Railway that went over to Caerphilly to tap the coal of the Frymney Valley. And then below us here, domination of road over rail can be seen in the beginnings of the construction of the A470 dual carriageway from Cardiff up to Abercynon, as it was when it first opened. So all the ocean pits have closed. The last one to go was Deep Navigation in 1987. A small chunk of the Barry Railway remains open between Cogan and Barry, and the Vale of Glamorgan Railway, which was associated with the Barry Railway, which ran from Barry to Bridgend, is also still open today. Barry Docks, the decline in the coal trade has meant that Barry Docks hardly see any business whatsoever nowadays. And I suspect that the dock would have been closed were it not for the fact that a chemical works, Dow Corning's, was established at the eastern end of the number 2 dock because the sea is the only safe way of bringing in some of the dangerous chemicals that are required by the Dow Corning plant in its work. But an element of David Davis's entrepreneurialism still exists today. The nationalisation of the coal industry and so on in 1947, in the 1940s, only included assets on the UK mainland. The Ocean Coal Company had bought a company called Wilson's, who owned an extensive chain of coaling stations, chiefly in Brazil and Argentina in South America. And this company survives to this day, Ocean Wilson's Holdings Limited. It's based, it's a classic international company. I think its registered offices in Bermuda, but most of its operations are in container terminal operation at the former coaling stations on the Brazilian and Argentinian coasts, and also it's now pretty clear that there are extensive oil deposits in the Atlantic Ocean off the coast of Brazil. At the moment, the price of oil does not make it worthwhile going to exploit those sources. But I think there is a rather pleasant symmetry in the fact that David Davis would recognise something of what he established in during his remarkable lifetime, a company involved in the operation of ports and the exploitation of mineral reserves. Diolch yn fawr iawn.